Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today is...
Steve.
Today's episode is all about Planet Earth 2. So we had the way that the television programme is made with the producers, and this is some of the science behind it.
So I sat down with Professor Rich Pankost, who is director of the Cabot Institute at the University of Bristol. He'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. He has such interesting and varied work with people all over the world, and I was fascinated, so I just kept asking questions, and he was happy to keep answering them.
He's not part of the BBC in any way, is he?
No, Rich works at the University of Bristol, and he directs the Cabot Institute. In the producers episode, they talked a lot about conservation and about engaging people through their medium. Rich and his colleagues do work about climate change, about working out how our planet works and how humans affect it and how it affects us. Anyway, it was fascinating, so I think we've edited this as little as possible as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm here in the School of Chemistry at the University of Bristol with Professor Rich Pankost.
Great to be here.
Rich, you're a chemist?
I'm a geologist who uses chemistry, so I'm a geochemist. I cross the boundary.
And you're also director of the Cabot Institute.
That's right. Absolutely. So as a geochemist, my research is based upon using geochemical signatures, all sorts of geochemical signatures that you can find in rocks. Mm-hmm. And that helps me understand how the Earth works. What might happen as permafrost thaws? What might happen to methane in the ocean as the ocean's warm? But because I'm a geochemist, I can look at them not only in soils and sediments, I can look at these signals in rocks that are 1,000 years old or 100 million years old. So I also look at how these processes and how the Earth has evolved through time. I try to look at how the Earth worked in the past so we have a better understanding of how it works in the future. So that's the day job, that's the research job. As the Cabot Institute job is well, it's a great deal of fun, but it's a lot more challenging and ambitious. And the remit of the Cabot Institute is to study all the ways that we depend on and impact our planet. All the ways you expect food, water, energy security, global environmental change, natural hazards, but also global development, cities, all of the things that you might expect, but often some unexpected things. We might end up talking about the NHS if we're concerned about how climate change might affect health. So very, very broad, but the real mission of the Cabot Institute is bringing all disciplines together. Social scientists, engineers, also people from outside the university, NGOs, civil society, politicians, all sorts in the sort of intellectual melting pot to come up with new ideas. That's our real goal.
With regards to the Cabot Institute, are there any big goals in the short or long term?
Our main goal is to build a real thriving and dynamic community. My ambition would be is at some point you don't need a Cabot Institute because all the social scientists over in law or space or policy studies, they know the engineers and they know the scientists and they're all connected, so they're all working together. And that's more of a philosophical goal, but I think in terms of challenges, really where our attention is, whether we're looking at Bristol or the globe, how do we develop our society? How do we develop global society to become more equal, but also more sustainable with all the resources we use and not degrade the environment while doing so?
Mm. What sort of range of people do you collaborate with? Is it UK research? Is it global?
All sorts, really. I mean, that's what's exciting about being the Cabot Institute. On one day, I might be working with nuclear engineers about how nuclear energy is safe. I might be working the next day with a group of people who think we don't want nuclear energy, we want to develop new renewables. Sometimes I might be working with the mayor of Bristol. Sometimes I might be working with the Government Office of Science. Sometimes I might be working with a global development agency. And when I say I'm working with them, I really mean I'm just sort of brokering the relationship between the really brilliant academic and the potential partner. But literally in a single day, I could be working from someone from a community center in Bristol to someone who represents a global international business. I mean, from a philosophical point of view, what we're doing right now as humans, we're changing the planet. And as a scientist, I think, well, this is a pretty big experiment. And I'm kind of curious how this experiment turns out. But really, it's an experiment. We don't want to wait and see how it turns out. We want to see whether or not there's past experiments that might give us some insight into what might happen. So we go and we look in the past. What happened the last time the Earth was warmer? What happened the last time the Earth warmed very, very quickly, similar to today? Now, that's a bit of an art because I don't have a time machine. So what we do as geologists, we go back through the geological record. We go back through those rocks, those sediments, all the things you will have seen on the Jurassic coast. We know the ages of those. We use a whole range of techniques to pull information out of those rocks. And by now, I'm talking about the entire geological community. So, for example, if you see a coal, you know it was wet. If you see salt, you know it was dry. If you see a crocodile, you know it was warm. If you see palm trees, you know it was warm, even if it's in Antarctica. So we have this huge range of information that we pull on. My work is to try to use chemical signatures, organic compounds, compounds made by microorganisms. And microorganisms make their organic compounds to manage their relationship with the environment. So a single-celled organism, its cell wall, its cell membrane, that's all that exists between it and the environment it lives in. So it needs to modify the compounds in that. Those compounds can be preserved in a 100-million-year-old rock. So by looking at them in all sorts of ways, I can estimate how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere, because that affects photosynthesis by those organisms. I can estimate how warm the water was or how warm the air was, because those organisms had to make their fats in a way that that were stable at those temperatures. Not too liquid, not too hard. That's how we work. And from that, you can tell a story through a great amount of evidences. During certain time periods, carbon dioxide was higher in concentration. That led to this much warming. That led to this much sea level rise. That affected storms in this way. I then go talk to the paleontologists, and they tell me how it affected ecosystems, and we begin to tell a story about how changes in climate affect the Earth.
Fascinating. that's mind-blowing, the fact that you can look at what's in the rock, even if it's right. Not inside around an organism's fossil. The rocks are made from organisms in
absolutely.
Some cases,
So a lot of information, and if we look at this field going back 100 years ago, it was based upon those fossils. They'll tell us a lot, and that's what we see. As I said, you see the fossil of the palm tree or the fossil of a crocodile. That tells you something. But what we work on is we're working on those microorganisms. Mm. So they're just dispersed in the rock. But what's quite useful about those small organisms is that they have a more intimate relationship with their environment. So, for example, if you go to Antarctica, you're not going to really change your chemical composition. Mm. And if you go to the tropics, you still won't change your chemical composition. But some of these microorganisms, they will. Mm-hmm. They'll make these subtle changes. And that allows us to go a bit further from hot and cold to 25 to 30 degree temperature versus 0 to 10 degree temperature. So, mm-hmm. So we can never pin down the temperature because we don't have that time machine to take our thermometer back there. We can begin to put some numbers on it. And that's really useful.
Crocodiles in the Antarctic.
Oh, yeah. Earth history has experienced a huge range of climate variations. Mm-hmm. There's times when the Earth has been much, much colder. We colloquially will call snowball Earth, when there are glaciers all the way down to the equator. So much colder. But there's also been many times in Earth history where there's been no continental ice. No ice on Antarctica. No ice on Greenland. Much warmer world. Palm trees and crocodiles living on the edges of Antarctica. The Earth's climate changes naturally, but that tends to happen very, very, very slowly.
We've been watching the new Planet Earth 2 series.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
We absolutely love it. What do you think?
That's brilliant. I mean, it's epic drama, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I've loved it. I think it's always amazing the stories that are told by beginning to actually see bits of nature that we couldn't see without these rather intrepid photographers and teams going out and what's fascinating is what we're actually learning about animal behavior, and sometimes. It's fascinating, isn't it? The last episode that I saw was the one where you had entire ant colonies and the leafcutter ants, right? They're cutting off specific bits of leaves and specific links, taking it into their colonies, then using them to grow fungus And the fungus is what they eat. So basically, these ants are farmers. It makes us feel perhaps a little bit more humble.
That blew my mind. I get my mind blown every couple of minutes right. when I watch yeah. those episodes. But what do you think about this, sort of the time we're in now compared to the time 10 years ago?
Yeah, it was about 10 years ago, yeah. right? Reflecting back on my work as a paleoclimatologist, as a geochemist, I tend to think in the time frames of millions and millions of years. And in that, everything that we're seeing going on in the world is going to just be a blip. But it's not going to be just a blip. We're having this huge impact on the planet. And we've been talking about this, whether it's climate change or pollution or habitat loss, been talking about it for 30 or 40 years. We've had some great wins, you know, clean water and clean air acts. So, you know, Britain has, we have cleaner beaches now than we have had in decades. But it feels like those tiny little wins are being offset against some really significant losses. You know, we've had some agreements, but CO2 concentrations are still going up. Global temperature is still going up. 2016 will be the hottest record in human records.
So moving on to a bit more about the science, what do we understand at the moment and how confident are we about it with regards to climate change?
Yeah. Before we start on climate change, it's worth pulling back, since we're talking about okay. planet Earth, to just note that climate change is not the only threat, obviously, to these habitats. A lot of it is due to habitat loss. Some of it's wasteful, some of it's necessary to agriculture, to feed our planet and such. There's pollution and a wide range of issues. So climate change does not sit alone. It sits there with a number of very, very critical issues. But climate change often is the most contentious. But it's not contentious in the scientific community. There's a lot of misconceptions that flow out around on Google that sometimes confuses people, but the broad messages are clear. Carbon dioxide, more of it in the atmosphere, and that is due to human activity. No one denies that. 400 parts per million, that's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than we have had for the last 1 million years, probably for the last 3 million years. We also know that carbon dioxide will make the planet warmer. There's a little bit of debate, and we really try to grapple with the issue of how much warmer, but broadly, we know that if we carry on as we are, by the end of the century, Earth will be somewhere between 4 and 6 degrees warmer. There's a range, but we understand the basics, don't we? Where it gets more interesting, as you think, is when you begin to explore how will that affect an ecosystem? How will it affect an organism? How will it affect rain? How will it affect agriculture? Extreme events. There's a lot of science that goes into all of those, and we again have some broad understandings, but to be fair, the uncertainty about some of those effects. Will hurricanes become more intense? Will droughts become more protracted? The evidence is yes, but to be fair, there is more uncertainty with those. And those are often the things that we're most concerned about. There's a great deal of consensus in the scientific community. Consensus is not fact, but at least it shows where the body of evidence lies. There's a pretty good public understanding, despite a lot of these myths that get out there. So I think that I think the public is a lot smarter than we often give them credit for. I think they're able to navigate through all of this. Nonetheless, it does not help when you have a lot of myths being thrown out there. One particular myth, of course, is that warming had stopped. But, I mean, this is basically based upon taking about a 150-year record, cherry-picking a window of time of about 15 years that just happens to be a relative straight line, and drawing a line through it and never showing anyone the rest of the 150-year record. And of course, if you take any sort of curve that has some wiggles and variations in it, you can draw some very creative lines. Another one is a little bit more based in truth, but is somewhat manipulated, which is that carbon dioxide is necessary for photosynthesis. So more carbon dioxide will mean a vast greening of the planet. There's an element of truth to that. More carbon dioxide will allow some plants to grow. And actually, many plants have soaked up some of the carbon dioxide we've put in the atmosphere. For the next couple of decades, that might continue, and we might have somewhat higher crop yields. However, that is then greatly exaggerated and extrapolated into create a narrative of carbon dioxide creating this vast green planet with thriving agriculture, rather ignoring the fact that plants don't just need carbon dioxide, they also need water. And droughts will offset all the good that the carbon dioxide does. The other thing about that myth is that that effect begins to plateau at about 400 to 500 parts per million. So that added carbon dioxide keeps making the planet warmer, keeps disrupting your rainfall patterns, keeps having all these negative impacts on plants and crops without any of the good stuff. So this is actually the really tricky part for anyone to really understand. Policymakers, industry, the public. There's an element of truth that can be very easily misrepresented to create a narrative of climate change is actually not that bad. And that is very challenging.
I did do my homework properly. I looked at the first couple of pages of Google results.
Right.
But then when I searched in Google Scholar, which searches peer-reviewed journals and conference papers, then the consensus was much more obvious.
That's right. One of the things I think that is particularly challenging when talking about climate change is there are things that are very well understood and there are things that are not well understood. And it is very easy to conflate the two and create a message of people don't actually have any idea what's going to happen. It's far too soon to act on climate change. Why worry about it? And that's a very deceptive manipulation of the consensus. You would have seen if you read those papers. Those papers will have said CO2 coming from humans, CO2 increasing, CO2 causes warming of about this amount. This will likely lead to more extreme weather events. This could have impacts on ecosystems. Notice how my verbs are changing there. I went from CO2 is increasing as a fact to CO2 could have impacts on ecosystems. There's a risk there. That's why we're cautious. We're concerned about that. There is evidence that it is affecting ecosystems, but the exact impacts, well, it'll depend upon the ecosystem. It'll depend upon a wide range of factors. So there's a bit of uncertainty when people drill down and say, is climate change going to make my backyard wetter? Well, okay, that's a really important question. And we have real trouble answering that question. But it doesn't mean we don't know that carbon dioxide is going to cause global warming.
I can see where the difficulties start coming in now, particularly with communicating this to the public.
Right.
Bob down the road wants to know what's going to happen to his cucumbers.
Absolutely.
And if we can't give him an answer on that, then who are we to say anything about the world?
Right. And I think actually what becomes, something becomes a little bit more nuanced. Some groups of climate deniers will manipulate that uncertainty cynically. I think when it comes to how we as individuals engage with climate change science, it's a lot more nuanced. I think, Bob down the road will accept the science, but he won't be clear about exactly how it affects him. Mm-hmm. He won't be able to connect it to his daily life, both because of the uncertainty, but also because this is uncertainty about what might happen 10 years from now. So if Bob is worried about his job, he's worried about his healthcare, those are his immediate concerns. That's what dictates his behavior. And I think that's the more challenging issue of climate change, is trying to connect these things to people's real lives. One of the things that we try to do is we try to move away from this language of prediction, saying, here is what's going to happen to your cucumbers. And we try to say, here are the potential risks to your cucumbers. We're not saying that's going to happen, but it's a risk. Because people are used to thinking about risks. That's why we buy insurance. There's a risk your home might burn down and you make decisions based upon that. So I think we need to begin to change the language in a way that recognizes the uncertainty, but still helps people understand why they should take action.
One of the myths that I read was people saying, oh, global warming? It's been cold all summer. How is that a thing?
Right. And to be fair, that's not really climate deniers. That's sort of our own individual understanding of our own lived experience versus what scientists are telling us. And what the difference is that it's basically the difference between climate and weather. And it's very easy to confuse the two. Weather is what we experience in a certain week in a specific location. And it's what we experience. I'm out there shoveling the snow. I'm out there turning up the heat. I am living that cold snap. I'm living that record cold temperature, not experiencing global warming. So that is really, really understandable. But all I would say is that climate is the whole story of our whole planet on a long-term timescale. And just because you have a cold snap, in your town does not change the fact that the whole planet, year on year, is getting warmer. Weather and climate are not quite the same things.
Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic and really empathetic answer. It's important to understand the people side of this. There was stuff about the hockey stick graph and there being a pause in it.
Yeah, so one of the most powerful figures, and this is a little bit more related to my own research, is looking at the past to put what we're doing in some sort of context. Now, there's a real interesting trick that people are doing when they pick on the hockey stick curve, which is, first of all, they're ignoring physics. Physics, if I were to tell you we're going to put something on the hob and turn on the gas, you know it's going to get warmer. You know it's going to get warmer. That's physics. We put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we know it will get warmer. The reason the hockey stick curve, and this is a record of global temperatures over about the past 1,000 years, the reason this is such a powerful record is that it actually shows a stable climate for hundreds of years up until about 1900 or so, when temperatures then began to rise, and certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, when they really began to rise rapidly during the human activity. That curve proves what we already knew. CO2 causes the Earth to get warmer. But the reason climate deniers like to challenge that curve is because it has great symbolic power. It's a very compelling graph. And they challenge it in ways that are very much mired in statistical arguments. Because to generate that curve, the authors, including Michael Mann and several others, several of his colleagues, they had to compile a huge range of records. So it's a great statistical exercise. And there's different ways you could treat the data. But the National Academy of Science has gone back and they have looked at that methodology and they have confirmed that, by and large, with various statistical treatments, you see the same thing. There's a lot of little things that people try to pick up on that curve, you know, to pick at it. One is they'll say, Little Ice Age. Where's the Little Ice Age? The Little Ice Age was astonishingly cold. No, it wasn't. The Little Ice Age was cold in Europe. And so it's in all the Dutch paintings. It's in all Europe's records. It is part of our story of Western Europe. Yes, Europe was colder. But the world? Not so much. So again, there's lots of little things that you can pick up that are half-truths to sort of attack some of these records. And we have rebutted all of them. If you ever want to sort of find a good website that goes through all of these myths together and one by one tackles them and explains why, as I've just done there, there's one called Skeptical Science. And it's quite useful. It's a good guide to debunking many of these myths.
Excellent. We'll find that and put a link on the description.
Great.
Last two. Okay, word for word on this one. CO2 isn't the main driver of global warming.
Oh, well, that depends upon the context that you're looking at. So as a climate scientist who's looked at hundreds of millions of years of Earth history, there's all sorts of things that might have driven global warming in the past. The real question is, what is driving the warming now? And that is carbon dioxide. There's all sorts of other explanations that people have put out. They've said, what about solar forcing? What about the sun? The sun is very a major contributor to how warm our planet is. However, solar activity cannot explain the warming we have seen over the past half century. In fact, many aspects of solar activity suggest that the Earth should have been getting colder during that time. And in fact, it's getting warmer. So you can rule out all of these other explanations and all you're left with for the warming that has happened at an unprecedented rate over the past 100 years, and especially the past 50 years, is carbon dioxide put in the atmosphere by humans burning fossil fuels. There's no other explanation that can explain this warming trend. And of course, as I was alluding to earlier, that makes sense because physics.
Glaciers receding, ice melting, these things are cyclic, and if you look at a very long time, then the Earth was it as hot as it is now in the past?
So we're cycling back to my research, right? So we were talking how I look at times in the past where the Earth was much, much colder. There's times when the Earth was much, much warmer. We can look more recently over the past million years where we had ice ages, sometimes much colder, sometimes a little bit warmer than today. The Earth does change. The Earth's climate does change over hundreds of thousands of years to millions of years of timescales. However, there's an implicit statement in that argument. And what it is the Earth changes for reasons we just don't even understand. It changes because that's what the Earth does. It's random, it's variable. No. We look at Earth history, and it helps us understand exactly why climate changes. It tells us what the key variables are. And what it tells us is that carbon dioxide is one of the main drivers of climate change. It's sort of like walking into a bar and everybody's getting really, 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 really drunk and they're all falling down and you go there night after night, everybody's falling down, they're always a bit stumbling. And then you go in there and you basically shove someone over and you say, well, that guy fell down, it had nothing to do with me, people are falling over all the time in this bar. There's a real manipulative trick by saying climate changes, therefore we can't change climate. Climate changes, we study that to learn how climate changes, what drives it. What we have learned from that is if you dramatically increase carbon dioxide, you will change climate. One last thought about those past climate changes. In general, they all happened far, far, far more slowly than what we're doing right now. And not only does that put what we're doing in a particular context as being unique in geological history, but it is also quite concerning because we don't actually know how much of the Earth's system, and especially the Earth's ecosystems, are going to respond to this particularly rapid rate of warming.
You mentioned about sort of cherry-picking evidence or looking at a narrow view of something. I agree, if you look at a small portion of something, you can pick a bit that says whatever you want it to. I know in medicine and other fields where there's a lot of evidence-based stuff, maybe on slightly shorter timescales than what we're looking at with climate change, that there are institutions that do meta-reviews.
They look at
all the available, well-regarded papers on a subject, sometimes thousands and thousands of different studies, and bring them together to evaluate the consensus. And then you can look at whether one paper is disagreeing with 1,000 other papers.
That's right.
And get a more balanced view. Do we do the same with climate science?
We do, and what we have is we have a process, an organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it produces reports about every 5 to 6 years or so. That does exactly what you're talking about. It brings together several thousand scientists, perhaps compiling tens of thousands of research papers to bring together as exactly as you described, a meta-analysis. Now, again, there's some groups that claim that that we shouldn't trust this because it's the intergovernmental and it sits under the auspices of the United Nations framework on climate change. So it's sort of easy to cynically politicize that. It's a governmental process. It is owned by the United Nations. It is not an objective scientific process. That is not true because the people who produce it, all of them are scientists. Some of the reports begin to explore how it will affect people. Then we're in training social scientists. These reports, although it is under the auspices of government organizations, are produced by experts and scientists. So it is exactly what you said. It is a meta-analysis of where the field thinks it is. And you know, consensus is a very interesting thing. I would never want a consensus to dictate the thriving exploration of science. Science thrives because people challenge consensus. Nonetheless, if you're going to decide whether or not to get a heart transplant or not, you want to have a sense of what the consensus is at that point. And people in government, if they're going to decide whether or not they're going to act on climate change, they need to know what the consensus is. Consensus is not a good thing for science challenging itself. Consensus is important for the public, for industry, for policymakers to make decisions based upon our best understanding of the science at that particular point in time. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Again, it feels to me, my sample size of N equals one,
right? Yeah.
That there's a disconnect between what scientists, experts in climate change, say that we should do, or say the problem is at least,
right,
and what the social, political, economic aspects that influence what we actually do as a species.
We have come to an agreement across almost every nation on the planet in Paris at the end of 2015, an agreement that in principle will limit warming to 2 degrees or to well below 2 degrees, but our actions are not living up to the aspirations of that agreement. So now actually what you're really seeing is not a disconnection between the scientists and the policymakers. You're seeing a disconnection between the policymakers and their policies. Because all, as I said, almost all the governments of the world have agreed to a target. They've accepted the science. But they're not enacting policies that will make it happen. This is a very interesting but subtle shift. And I think this creates the space where we can challenge policymakers. Are you going to live up to your commitments? Are you going to live up to your obligations? And I am open to any suggestions. I'm open to Richard Branson coming up with fancy new technology as an entrepreneur. I'm up to the engineers at my university coming up with brand new battery storage technology. It could be technological. It could be social. It could be behavior change. It could be cap and trade policies. I am open to a portfolio, a diversity of methods to actually decarbonize our economy. But we better start soon, because if you want everyone to change their behavior and stop flying and stop driving, that will take a long time. If my engineering friends need to come up with a whole new class of airplanes that do not require fossil fuel, well, maybe we should be spending some money on that innovation right now. If all of us in the UK, 80% of us or so, we have gas central heating. Well, if we want to eventually wean ourselves off gas in the next 20 or 30 years, let's not wait 20 or 30 years. Let's start now. So basically, there's a lot of putting off till tomorrow what we should be starting today. And that's where the disconnect is. There's a lack of urgency.
In terms of my own actions. Mm. I know that I prefer cooking on gas.
Right.
It's easier.
Yeah,
it's,
I do as well.
It's more effective.
Absolutely.
But I should change to an electric cooker because then it can be fueled by renewable sources.
That's absolutely right. When we think about a whole renewable electricity revolution, that revolution goes a lot further if we have electric cars and we have electric heating. I think what we want to do is we want to create a framework, not where someone like you says, oh my God, I must convert my whole house over, but rather that when your boiler goes, that you view that as an opportunity to switch rather than putting a huge amount of money into your replacement boiler. Make it easy, make it gradual. Let's not all try to do it all at once.
What's the most important message that you'd like to get across to our listeners?
Well, all right, so I'll give a broad one to the public, and I'll give a special one to the Cosmic Shed audience. I think, to the general public, I would say, what we need to do is we need to basically take carbon out of our society in the next 30 years. So if you feel like, don't feel guilty about what you're not doing tomorrow. Think about what type of journey you as an individual want to go on over the next 20 or 30 years. So again, coming back to your gas central heating example or your gas hob example, you don't need to race out tomorrow and do it. But when the opportunity arises, take the opportunity. So that would be my message. Just go on this journey towards removing carbon. Now, to your more science fiction fascinated Cosmic Shed core audience, one of the problems that we face is that when I say a carbon-free world, when I say in the short term we have to fly less, in the long term, we need to stop flying entirely or create a brand new airplane. People really pull back. They think, wow, that is a good change. That is a huge change. How is that even going to happen? People who read science fiction and also people who understand the history of technology innovation realize there's a lot that we are capable of once we are capable of imagining it. That's always been the strength of science fiction. It's always been the strength. It's not because, in the 1950s, we imagined flying cars. We imagine a whole range of things, some of which happen faster, some of which happen slower. It's the ability to imagine a future. And once we can imagine that future, then we can get on with the business of making it happen. So that's what I would do. Go out. I say this as a science fiction fan. Perhaps we put a little bit more attention into those positive, innovative futures, even though as science fiction fans, we do kind of love our dystopian futures because it makes particularly good drama. But science fiction aficionados are particularly good at imagining, and we need a lot of that right now.
Thanks, Steve. That was fascinating.
He's absolutely fantastic. And the work that he and the Cabot Institute do is really, really important. Rich actually had an extra message, which he thought you might be interested in about some other work that he and colleagues do alongside that.
Okay.
So, Andrew, hello there. This is a colleague of mine. He's in the School of Geographical Sciences, Dan Lund. He studies past climate just like I do, but instead of being a geochemist, he's a climate modeler. So all the climate models we use to predict the future, he takes the climate models, he reconfigures them for past geographies, past mountain ranges, past ice sheet size, past CO2 levels, rearranges all of that. So the same mathematics, but different configuration of the continents, and he models past climate. Now, if you can model past climate by moving the continents all around, you can model any climate. And that concept was part of an engagement project that Dan did on a grant that we were both involved with. I hesitate to say we're both involved with because this was Dan's baby. And what he said is, if I can model the climate of the world 150 million years ago, I can model the climate of Middle Earth.
Andrew's just fallen off his chair.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, and you got to talk to Dan about this because Dan is a Tolkien aficionado. So he's using the Silmarillion. He's using all these things to sort of ask questions like, say, okay, well, I've got this map, but it's only part of the world. So how do I read the text to infer what I do with the rest of the planet? How big do I make a planet? How big is Middle Earth? Do I just assume it's the size of Earth? Do I assume it's smaller? If you email him, Dan will send you the paper. I think he, you know, you won't find it under his name because he publishes as Radagast the Brown, as one would.
What do you think about that?
I think we need to do the Cosmic Shed live somewhere that inspired Tolkien to write those books and get those guys along.
Professor Rich Pancost and Radagast the Brown.
Yeah, everybody. Gandalf. Let's get Gandalf in. But thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed our two episodes on Planet Earth 2 as much as we enjoyed recording them. And we'll be back very soon with another episode, but I've no idea what that will be about.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.